Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series, where we bring you readings of short stories from the magazine's past issues. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine publishes 6 double issues a year, full of the best mystery and crime short fiction. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. In our June 2010 issue, we published Madame Selina by Janice Law, the first in a delightful series featuring mid-19th century medium and spiritual advisor Madame Selina, aka Mrs. Bickerstaff. The stories are told by her helper, a young orphan called Nip. A prolific writer, Janice Law has been publishing stories with us and in our sister magazine, Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, for more than 20 years. Her 1977 novel, The Big Payoff, inspired by the Watergate scandals, was a finalist for an Edgar Award for Best Mystery. More recently, the novels in her historical series, featuring painter Francis Bacon, had been shortlisted for the Lambda Literary Award, with her 2013 novel, The Prisoner of the Riviera, receiving the award. Her newest novel, a contemporary, is Homeward Dove, published in 2016 by Wildside Press. Now, here is Janice Law reading her story, Madame Selina.
After Pa died, the farm sold up and the debts paid, there was just enough left to send me by train to the orphan farm, where I lived on thin soup and old bread until Madame Selina arrived. Naturally, she wasn't Madame Selina that day, but Mrs. Hiram Bickerstaff, and she wanted, as I heard her tell old Farquhar the overseer, a likely capable boy less than 5 feet tall. She was very explicit on that last point, and the first thing she did when I was brought into the chilly visitor's reception room was to pull out a measuring tape and check my height. "A very healthy boy," wheezed old Farquhar. "Very healthy," was his description of all but the terminally consumptive. Mrs. Bickerstaff gave me a close look, and I returned the favor because she wasn't the usual harried wife looking for a cheap farmhand or a sturdy girl of all work. She had a wide black hat with a plume big enough for an undertaker's horse, and a fur-trimmed black cape like a war widow's. But her skirt was a deep maroon, and her blouse, shiny as ice, was the color of thick cream. She asked if I could read and write, which old Farquhar answered in the affirmative, and then to see my hands, which I produced for myself. "Yes," she said, "I think he'll do." Before I knew rightly what was what, I was sitting in a carriage opposite Mrs. Bickerstaff with my Sunday clothes and my extra shirt done up in a bundle with the last of Pa's books, and the orphan farm buildings were flying backwards into the distance. I was frightened and excited, the more so when I realized that we were headed into the city, although not my wildest imaginings could have prepared me for the job Mrs. Bickerstaff had in mind, which only goes to show that I lacked the outsized imagination of my new patron. Imagination was not required for me in any case, for Mrs. Bickerstaff, whom I must now call Madame Selina, had enough for the whole household, which included Hilda the cook, Maddie the chambermaid, 2 tortoiseshell cats, and a large savage green parrot. More important than all of us, although I did not meet him immediately for the very good reason that he'd been dead nearly 1,700 years, was Aurelius, short for Marcus Aurelius, who'd lived in Rome, Italy, and been an emperor and written a book, all of which seemed almost equally wonderful to me. But Aurelius was for down the road. As soon as I joined the household, I was put to work, learning the peculiar arts Madame needed. I must fit myself into a big upright cupboard that backed up against one wall of what she called her salon. That salon, not saloon, which, thanks to Pa, I was more than familiar with. My entry was not, as you'd imagined, through the door, but via an opening cut in the wall from a small closet. For reasons unclear to me, I had to get from hall to closet to cupboard soundlessly and in pitch darkness. Whenever I was set to practice, Madame, The cats and the parrot listened in the room beyond for the slightest little bump or rustle. One of the felines was particularly keen, and had Madame not been kind and the food good, I would have made sure something befell Sir Benjamin Cat. This was not all. No sooner had I mastered the cupboard than I had to acquire other strange skills. The manipulation of certain fine strings and cords that ran who knows where and were attached to who knows what. There was even a little bellows which had to be filled with smoke from the balky kitchen fire, carried in complete darkness to the cupboard and discharged through a small hole in one of the doors. Once I met Aurelius, all became clear. Madame was a medium and spiritual advisor who with Aurelius gave counsel on everything from matters of the heart to stocks on the street. Her clientele was rich and ambitious, the brokers and traders, or wealthy and grieving, the war widows. Between the two, Madame made a very nice living. Not that we didn't work for it. Besides my gymnastic efforts kept up to snuff with daily practice, Madame spent mornings with the newspapers and stock reports, and afternoons when not conducting her seances and advising her clients, doing research of one sort or another. When I turned out to be a likely boy, I was enlisted to run errands to the papers, the town hall, her brokers, and even to various cemeteries where I was instructed to find stones and dates and such useful details as confirmed Madame Selina's special powers. One day I asked why she didn't just ask Aurelius about some detail or other. Madame was indignant. What would Aurelius know about railroad stocks? He's never even seen a train. No, we can't overburden him. And you know, dropping her voice as if the late emperor might be listening, he's a bit lazy. He can't always be relied on. Had I thought about it, I would have figured out that running psychic errands for even a lady of Madame Selina's talents was a come-down for the emperor of the Romans. But I was more troubled by another possibility. But isn't he real? I asked. It was important that he be real, that Madame, whom I'd come to like, be genuine. Certainly he's as real as you or me, boy, but like us, he has his days. Not being acquainted with the finer points of the afterlife, I put aside my doubts. Madame was a cheerful woman who made her clients happy, or at least happier, and as her unimaginative apprentice, I was a lot better off than I'd been at the orphanage, or even, if I was honest, on the farm. I only became uneasy again with the arrival of Lydia Fuller, our favorite client. My favorite, anyway, and perhaps Madame's too, because she worked hard on the case. Mrs. Fuller arrived one dreary afternoon, rain streaming off her black umbrella and spotting her black cloak and her rustling black skirt, for she was in deepest mourning for her husband, a young lieutenant missing since Gettysburg. I was used to widows. We had at least two a week, and usually more, but rarely were they as lovely as Mrs. Fuller. She was tall and very pale and blonde, with clean, even features, large gray eyes, and a finely shaped mouth. She looked like one of Madame's marble statues come to life, or almost to life, because her expression was unchanging, her perfect oval face a blank with all its thoughts and secrets hidden. Just the same, I loved her from the instant she handed me her umbrella in Madame's ornate foyer. Most of our ladies only came for the session or two needed for Aurelius to make contact with the spirits of those who passed. A few returned occasionally, or even more than occasionally, seeking advice or solace from the ghostly remains of their loved ones. I found that peculiar. I hardly remembered Ma, and I am not sure what I would have asked Pa. I don't think anything in his experience could have helped me in my new employment, though, of course, translated as he was, Madame always referred to the departed as translated, it was conceivable that he was already on speaking terms with Aurelius. Mrs. Fuller, however, had another more worldly request. She wanted Aurelius to find her husband's body. This was after Madame and I had exerted ourselves to the utmost to make contact with the lieutenant. I'd nearly been choked with smoke creating the ectoplasm that drifted eerily in the faint candlelight, and Madame had collapsed and gone into a full trance. Aurelius spoke in his hollow baritone, Then, very soft and far away, Timothy Fuller called, "Liddy, Liddy, is that you?" Mrs. Fuller fainted dead away and toppled off the sofa. Maddie hustled in with smelling salts, and I squirmed out of the cabinet and ran to get water. No one could say we hadn't done our best. But contact with the departed via a bona fide Roman emperor was not enough. Lydia Fuller wanted the lieutenant's body returned. The family had a mausoleum in the best cemetery in Brooklyn, and Mrs. Fuller said she'd never rest until he was laid there. "Difficulties, you know, my dear," said Madam. This was on a subsequent visit, for Madam was incapable of speaking immediately after a full trance, and was usually served supper in bed. And, of course, after all this considerable time, she didn't need to say more. We didn't need Aurelius to tell us the state of ill-buried or unburied corpses after a year or so in the fields at Gettysburg. Lydia Fuller's expression did not change. One of her brothers had been in a big army hospital in Washington, and she had gone down to nurse him. She had seen the worst, I suppose, but it didn't change her mind. Madam asked if she had checked with the Sanitary Commission and with Quartermaster Whitman, who was doing such good work locating the Union dead. Quartermaster Whitman says the battlefield was complete chaos. Some of the fallen were buried by their companions, and few of those graves are marked. Knowing now that Timothy really is dead, she put emphasis on that with a nod toward Madam, "I've come to you, Madam Selina, because all other attempts to find him have failed." "Very well," said Madam. But after Mrs. Fuller left, I could see that she was not happy, and this raised my sleeping doubts as well as my anxiety for Lydia Fuller. "Aurelius can find it," I said, not because I really believed this, but because, besotted with Mrs. Fuller and again doubtful of our enterprise, I wanted to put Madam on the spot. To my regret, I soon discovered that this was a case where Aurelius would need, as Madam put it, terrestrial assistance. Madam had a network of valuable men with invaluable contacts. But though I was sent thither and yon with messages, after a week we were no closer to the lieutenant's bones. Then, quite by accident, I turned our work in a different direction altogether. I was returning from an address near Washington Square when I saw Mrs. Fuller arm in arm with a top-hatted gent. He had a fine set of whiskers and an upright, almost military air, enhanced by his stiff right leg. But there was something about him I did not like. I especially didn't care for the way he leaned toward Mrs. Fuller, nor the confidential way he patted the hand that was linked through his arm. I couldn't see her face, so I did not know if her impassive features had changed. But as the presence of such a man was exactly the sort of information Madam cherished, I fell in behind them on their stroll up Broadway. When I returned home, Madam made me repeat his description half a dozen times until she was sure I had forgotten no detail. "And his name?" asked Madam. "Did you hear his name?" "She called him Colonel Parsons," I said. "A colonel, no less. We should be able to find him." Madam dispatched me to visit a florid-faced reporter named Jim Keynes. I sat on the edge of his desk in the smoky, chaotic, ink-stained newsroom while he finished scribbling his latest story, cursing everything from the town hall to a missing semicolon. Then he pulled a flask out of his desk, took a long drink, and asked what the old girl wanted this time. "She wants a Colonel Parsons," I said, and I gave my by now oft-repeated description. "What did he sound like? Is he a New York City man?" I thought a moment. "Not city," I said. "One of those who talks through his nose, eh, like a Dutchman in a windstorm?" And he mimicked my own northern twang. I nodded, too timid to add more. Keynes made a face and pursed his leathery cheeks, which were embroidered with an astonishing network of purple veins. "Maybe something in this? Maybe not," he said. "Tell the old girl to hold her horses, and I'll see what I can do." While we awaited his intelligence, Mrs. Fuller arrived for a seance. Madam once again went into a full trance. "An exhausting business," she remarked to me later. But Aurelius was not on form. All we got from him was that he saw the lieutenant struck down. "His arm is bleeding. "Oh, his poor arm is bleeding," the emperor intoned, before disappearing into the ether and my cloud of smoke. I figured a Roman emperor would be less flustered by blood, but a wounded arm did not sound lethal, which only meant, I suppose, that poor Fuller had bled to death on the way to the field hospital, or been ruined there by dysentery or infection. Shortly after this inconclusive session, Mrs. Fuller sent a note thanking Madam and informing us that she had good hopes of recovering the lieutenant elsewhere. This did not sit well with Madam Selina, who prided herself that she rarely lost a customer, and certainly never after two full trans sessions. "That rascal Parsons has turned her head. Maybe he was at Gettysburg," I said. "Maybe they served together." "Never. He was never a colonel either," said Madam, whose contacts had evidently been busy. "He bought his way out. But he'll find her a body. You see if I'm not right, and he'll pass it off as Timothy Fuller." "Why ever would he do that?" Madam raised an eyebrow as if my lack of imagination continued to amaze her. "Because Lydia Fuller is very rich, or will be, once it is certain that her husband is dead." "He fell at Gettysburg," I explained. "How can it be in doubt? And Aurelia spoke with..." "The soul can wander before death as well as after," said Madam Selina, making me think with a shudder of the poor cripples and drunkards and laudanum addicts who wandered the Bowery. Half of them were still wearing the rags of their old uniforms, a battle blouse, cracked cavalry boots, a forage cap. "Can't Aurelius tell?" I asked. "A ghost and an emperor's ghost at that should manage to tell the dead from the living." "Like as not he can," she said. "I don't know whether he will enlighten us. But as for Parsons, I'm guessing that he means to marry Lydia Fuller and make himself rich." "We must save her," I cried. "She must come and you must tell her. Maybe Aurelius will find the grave. He can, can't he?" "I think Fuller's grave will be far from Gettysburg," Madam Selina said mysteriously, before setting me to watch a certain doss house in the Bowery. I was to tell her immediately if I saw Colonel Parsons arrive, and I spent most of a rainy week crouched behind a rain barrel in the alley or sharing a pipe with one of the street boys. At last, when Madam Selina had begun to doubt my alertness and to despair of success, I saw the colonel appear in the doorway, talking to the evil-looking manager. I took this news home to Madam, who immediately dispatched me to her newspaper friend, who in turn grabbed his hat and his stick and set off at surprising speed for the police station. I was desperate to go with him, but he insisted I return to Madam. She ordered me into the dark clothes I wore during her consultations and bustled around preparing the salon. Finally, a knock at the door. A boy handed in a note. Madam read it, nodded, and sent me off with a message to Lydia Fuller. My fantasies come to life. I had often dreamed of running an errand to Mrs. Fuller's, and now I tore along the street to the horse cars with one of Madam's big, stiff envelopes clutched in my hand. I rode in style down Broadway, then walked to Mrs. Fuller's townhouse off Washington Square. There was a tiny garden in front, and an entry with gleaming brass fittings. A pert, beribboned maid wearing a pretty ruffled apron over her dove-gray dress took the letter and disappeared. I waited in the hall that was tiled like Madame Selina's, in a complex pattern of blue, brown, and white, and craned my neck to catch a glimpse of Mrs. Fuller. Voices in one of the rooms beyond. "What does this mean?" A low response. "Something, something, very soon." "Mail?" My heart jumped. Surely not, surely not. Surely nothing more than the butler. A minute more, then, Lydia Fuller herself stepped out into the hall. "Is she certain?" she asked me without preliminary. "Is Madam Selina certain?" Madam Selina had not confided in me, but I said confidently that I was sure she was. Mrs. Fuller bit her lip and seemed as close to vexed as her placid features would allow. "What am I to tell Madam Selina?" I asked. "We will be there," said Lydia Fuller. You can be sure that I puzzled that "we" all the way back and arrived in an uneasy mood. Madam Selina declined to enlighten me. Instead, she gave me strict instructions and sent me to the back of the house, where I found Mr. Jim Keynes, a copper nearly as red-faced as the reporter, and, most extraordinarily, a thin, gray-faced man of indeterminate age reclining on a chaise under a thick wool blanket. As we waited, he periodically asked for some medicine. Depending on his mood, Keynes either denied him with the admonition that he must keep his wits about him, or poured him a small ration of opium and whiskey. Beyond his dosage, the man, who was trembling with cold even in the warm parlor, seemed quite indifferent to anything but his blankets, which he kept plucking up under his chin. After what seemed a long time, there was a bustle in the hall, arriving clients. I cracked open the door and waited until they were all settled in the salon. Then, as directed, I crept away, not to my usual hiding place in the cupboard, but to a position near the door where I could hear what was going on. After a few minutes of whispering, I heard Madame give the curious little groan that signaled a trance. For not-so-serious cases, she went into a half-trance, where she was lucid but remote, as if dreaming with her eyes open. But for Mrs. Fuller's case, which I had begun to realize was more complex than I had imagined, only the full trance would do. There was a sort of soft thump. That was Madame collapsing back against her deep armchair. Then a silence. Normally, this would have been the time for my ectoplasm, but I understood that we had other helps for Aurelius this time, and sure enough, he appeared. "Are you there?" Madame asked. Her voice was weak and strange. "I am." A full octave lower, maybe two. "We have one here seeking knowledge." This was Madame's standard opening. "I am on a different errand," said Aurelius. "There is one here in danger." I could feel the hair rising on my neck. When I was in the special cupboard, I was too busy working the effects and too frightened of making any noise to pay attention. Standing in the hallway with the lamp turned low and the curtains twitching in the draft was another thing altogether. "Who is in danger?" Madame's voice, though no louder than a breath, carried out into the hall. "He is near," said Aurelius. "He is a prisoner, near home, but a prisoner." I waved my hand to signal Keynes as I had been instructed. "This is rubbish," said a man's voice. Parsons, I was sure. "His grave is ready for him," said Aurelius. "His death is awaited. His murderers are before me." Mrs. Fuller gave a cry. Then there was a shout and the sound of a chair toppling. "Do you deny it?" asked Aurelius, his voice hollow yet loud. I opened the door, holding the candle aloft as Madame had instructed me, and Keynes half pushed the sick man through it. "Do you deny it now?" the Emperor asked. A scream, and the Colonel shouted, "Lights! Bring us lights!" He leapt to his feet and found the gas lamp filling the salon with dazzling light. Madame was slumped, her eyes rolled up in her head. Lydia Fuller was clutching the arms of her chair and screaming, her perfect features distorted, with fear, with surprise, with rage. "It's all up, Colonel," said the copper, stepping into the room. Parsons made a lunge. Despite his game leg, he was a big, strong fellow, surprisingly quick. He got past the officer, and as neither me nor Keynes was about to stop him, he had a clear shot at the door until the sick man stumbled into his path, and overbalanced, they both fell to the floor. The copper took the opportunity to lay his nightstick against the colonel's head. For a moment, there was only the sound of Madame gasping and of Mrs. Fuller sobbing before a police whistle shrilled, summoning heavy boots to the foyer. Madame's trance had been dangerously interrupted. I brought her some water while Maddie saw to Mrs. Fuller. Then Keynes and I helped the sick man to a seat by the fire. He looked older than Mrs. Fuller by many years and terribly feeble, but after Keynes applied another dose of his medicine, he was able to speak. "Don't you know me, Liddy?" Lydia Fuller had regained control of herself by this time. She knelt down beside him and took his hand. "We believed you died at Gettysburg." "Left a piece of me there," he said, gesturing with the 6 inches or so that remained of his left arm. "You did not come back. You did not write. What were we to think?" There was a sharp note in her voice that I had not heard before. "A bad time, Liddy. I was having a bad time when Parsons found me." His large, feverish eyes were immense in his wasted face. "Don't trust him, Liddy." "He has been most kind," she murmured, and something in her voice made me uneasy. "He kept me a prisoner," Timothy Fuller said, "of my weaknesses, Liddy." He closed his eyes and fell back into a drugged sleep. "What am I to do?" cried Mrs. Fuller. "Take him home, my dear, and see he gets well. You have had a narrow escape. Parsons is notorious for preying on widows, as Mr. Keynes here can tell you." Mrs. Fuller shook her head frantically and looked with horror at the wreckage of her husband. She seemed incapable of action. In the end, Madam, shaky as she was, had to call for her carriage and send Mattie home with them. "We saved his life and her money," said Madam later, "though neither seems very happy." I thought of Mrs. Fuller's white face and staring eyes. We had saved her and found her husband, yet she had looked as if she wanted to die. Madam had me open all the windows and burn lavender and rosemary in the fireplaces and carry the sick man's blankets immediately to the laundress and bathe, even though it wasn't bath night. Perhaps that saved us, for though Mattie was quite ill for a time, the rest of us were spared. Not so the Fullers. Sick as he was, Timothy Fuller strangely recovered, but beautiful, perfect Lydia succumbed to fever. Madam sent a wreath for her burial, and I saw her laid in the earth. "I wish we'd never helped Aurelius," I said, as we walked away from the Fuller mausoleum, a dark granite cube with columns at the front, in what Madam told me was the Egyptian manner. The other mourners were dispersing slowly. Lieutenant Fuller, wrapped in a thick shawl over his black suit and attended by his sister, a dark-haired girl who shared his lean features. "I wish he'd stayed wherever he stays." "You wouldn't eat half so well if he did," said Madam. "And you were keen to save her from the colonel. She didn't ask to be saved. It's a mistake, I found, to go beyond the client's wishes." I nodded my head. "Seeing my misery," Madam added, "but Colonel Parsons is a bad party, a very bad party indeed. She was not the first, you know. Mr. Keynes knew of him, but the colonel was clever. He'd covered his tracks very well. She'd be alive if we'd never found the lieutenant nor investigated the colonel. But her poor husband would be dead. And who knows what would have happened to her once Parsons had run through her money. He might have taken the fever instead. Anything might have happened. You know, she suspected from the first that her husband was alive," Madam said after a moment. "Did Aurelius tell you that?" "I had a lot against Aurelius, whom I blame for meddling in things he might well have left alone." "Indirectly," said Madam. "When Aurelius made contact and the lieutenant spoke, Mrs. Fuller fainted." "From the shock," I suggested. "From the shock, indeed. Most of my clients come hoping to hear from their loved one. She came hoping to find his grave. After that, I didn't need Aurelius to tell me that something was afoot."
That was Janice Law reading her story, Madame Selina, from the June 2010 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is a bi-monthly digest published by Dell Magazines. To learn more about us, we urge you to go to our website, themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital editions are also available at all major e-tailers. This podcast was produced with the help of Jackie Sherbo and Deanna McLafferty. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.